The Moth is brought to you by Progressive, home of the Name Your Price tool. You say how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. It's easy to start a quote. Visit Progressive.com to get started. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law. Apple Card is the perfect cashback rewards credit card. You can earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
From PRX, this is the Moth Radio Hour. I'm Jay Allison, producer of this show, and in this hour we present a live Moth event held at the Tabernacle in the town of Oak Bluffs on the island of Martha's Vineyard in Massachusetts. It was sponsored by Atlantic Public Media and public radio station WCAI, and the host was New Yorker staff writer Adam Gopnik.
It is wonderful to be here in this amazing space to tell you a few stories. Moth storytelling is special, but it's essentially very simple. You're going to hear 10-minute stories, no notes, nothing to help you when you're up here, and they have to be true stories. They have to be something you bring forward from your life. And the motto, the moral of every Moth story, I've often thought, should be that great line from Frank O'Connor, and everything that happened to me afterwards, I never felt the same about again. We have a theme tonight. Our theme tonight is fish out of water. And the stories you're going to hear are all about somebody who finds themselves out of place in a strange situation, in a circumstance they never anticipated, in the midst of something that seems utterly alien to them. And the way we introduce our storytellers here at the Moth, I ask the storytellers before the show, I ask them one simple skill-testing question that they have to answer so you'll get some sense of who they are and what they're all about. And the question that we chose tonight was, if there was one kind of person you could banish from the beach, who would it be? My own answer is anybody who brings the Sunday New York Times to the beach and is there with it flapping in the wind. But our first storyteller said the one person she would banish from the beach, from any beach, is anyone who has ever said, it is what it is. Good idea. Would you welcome, please, Jenny Allen.
Hello, hello. So I sit down at my 13-year-old daughter's computer because mine is in the shop. And here in front of me on her computer screen is her email inbox. Now, I hardly ever get to see her email inbox, except very fleetingly when I happen to be passing through the little nook in the hallway where we keep her computer, because the school has told the parents that they don't want the children to have their computers in their bedrooms, right? They should be in a more public and well-trafficked zone. So far, I am finding that this works a lot better in theory than in real life. Because in real life, if I go anywhere near her computer, she just flings her whole upper body over it and says, "You're invading my privacy," which I am. I'm kind of torn about this because I have these very mixed feelings about children and the computer and privacy. I feel kind of stuck because I can see both sides. Right? And anyway, she and I both know that if she doesn't want me to see what she's doing on her computer, all she has to do is hit one stroke on her keyboard, and whatever she's doing has been replaced instantly by the first sentences of her paper on The Lottery by Shirley Jackson. But apparently she just forgot to log out last night. So I sit there and I scroll down through her email inbox because I just can't help it. But I don't read her emails. I don't. I don't. Even though 2 days earlier I've heard this parenting expert on the Today Show tell the parents of America that we can read our children's emails and we should, and not in secret, he said. He said that the children shouldn't be doing anything on their computers that their parents shouldn't be able to see while standing over their shoulder. And, you know, I wondered at the time if this man had ever met a teenager. if he knew how much they don't enjoy having their parents standing over their shoulder, breathing down their necks. But I did kind of see his point, you know. I thought, well, we should be able to know what our kids are doing on the computer, shouldn't we? You know, I don't know. I just feel very insecure about it. Anyway, so I do sit there and I read the first line of my daughter's emails because they're right there in the subject line, right there for me to see. And all the emails seem to be from her friends, and they're all very innocuous. Although they're kind of taken as a whole, they're a little schizophrenic. Like, sometimes the kids write very childishly, like, I am so excited for Dunkin' D's. And then sometimes they write like gang members. They do. So strange. But now, and here, sort of down a ways in the queue, is kind of a strange one. There's nothing written in the subject line. And in the email sender's address box, there are no letters or names, just numbers, a big long series of numbers. And I think, well, maybe this is junk email. Or maybe she's ordered something from an online catalog, and that's the catalog order number, and they're going to charge me for something every month on my cable bill unless I take care of it right now. So I think, you know, I could open this email. You know, this one I could open. Be like opening a bill, which it may be, or like something addressed to occupant. You know, it's impersonal. So I do. And it's a photograph. And it's been taken at a strange angle, and it's kind of blurry, but not so blurry that you can't see it's been taken in a bathroom. There are tiles on the floor and a used towel down there, and these two large cup bras hanging from a hook on the back of a closed door, and not so blurry that you can't see the star of the picture right there in the foreground. And it is a big, erect penis. It is. And I think, oh my God, who sent her this photograph? Right? It's not from a porn site because the picture is just too bad and it's too intimate. You know, that organ is just right there in your face. I think, oh my God, is it someone she knows? Are we about to be a statistic? Is someone from the Huffington Post going to be calling our house asking for a quote on babies having babies? My baby. My baby who still gets the children's fair on Amtrak and still loves strawberry milk and making brownies and riding horses. I think, oh my God, maybe it's a stranger, someone she's never met who's just gotten her email address somehow. This is so creepy. So I decide to print out the photograph. I don't know why. Really, I don't know, but as I am printing it out, my older daughter, Hallie, and her friend Desiree stop by for a visit. Now, they are both 23, and they're all grown up, and they live in Brooklyn, and they're very cool, and they're very great. And I figure, well, they will calm me down somehow about this. Thank God they've come, right? And I hold out the photograph, and I say, look at this! And these two cool New York City girls, these girls you can't shock, say, oh my God! Because they don't know what to think either. And then Desiree says, oh, she remembers something. It's a fad. She read about it somewhere. The boys are taking pictures of their private parts and emailing them to the girls. And she says that those numbers in the email sender's address are actually the boys' iPhone phone number. Now, this is before we had a word for it. There was no, we didn't know it was called sexting. It wasn't called anything. It was new then. This was, again, some years ago. And Hallie says, oh, Mom, it's probably just some boy she knows trying to be funny. So I call the iPhone phone number because I want to know. You know. I want to hear the boy's voice, the boy who thinks he's trying to be funny or whatever he's trying to be. I want him to know that I know. Hello. It's a teenage boy's voice, I can just tell. Hello, I say, who's this? M, he says, giving me his name. And I have this parental urge to say, hey, you don't have to give me your name. You don't have to tell me anything. I'm a stranger. But I don't. And I say, hello, M, this is R's mother. And he says, who? And I say, R, are you a friend of hers? And he says, I guess. Kinda. And I say, where do you go to school? And he tells me, just like that. And it's not my daughter's school, so I think, well, you know, it seems pretty likely that this is a boy she doesn't know that well. I mean, she's never brought up his name, and he's never been to the house, and she brings her friends over all the time. So I think, well, you know, maybe it's just kind of one like what Hallie said, this kind of boy she doesn't really know that well, just trying to be funny. And I say, well, you know, Em, the reason I am calling you is because I found your iPhone phone number on my cell phone pad, and I didn't know who called me. And he says, after a long pause, oh. And I figure he knows, right? He's putting it together. And I say, well, nice talking to you. Bye. And he says, bye. Like, he could have just hung up on me, right? But he's polite. He's talking to a grown-up. It's just so strange. So I think, well, this is a boy she doesn't know that well who's indulging in a really disgusting fad, right? It's disgusting, but it's so disgusting that suddenly it seems kind of funny to me. And for the next 20 minutes, Hallie and Desiree and I just crack ourselves up about M and his member, right? And just while we're laughing about this, I hear the front door open and I realize it's my 13-year-old home from school and I just panic because I think, oh my God, I've been reading her email and I printed it out and she's just gonna kill me and I don't know what to do. And then I think, well, now listen, just stop. Don't make it some dark, heavy thing. Just keep it light, right? Keep it light. So what's my choice? The three of us are standing there with these big grins just frozen on our faces. And she comes into the room and she says, what? Because she wants to be in on the joke. And I say, honey, do you know who sent you this photograph? And she says, yes, ew, he's disgusting. And I said, so you know this boy? And she says, well, barely, I met him like twice, and he's disgusting. And I say, well, what's his point, really? I mean, is he trying to be funny? Does he want to be your boyfriend? And she says, I don't know. Ew, he's so disgusting. Why are you reading my email? But she's smiling, though, so I think she's going to forgive me, right? So for the next few days, Em and his member become this kind of running joke in our family. We make these little remarks about what we'd say if we ran into him on the street, about him and his member, and I think, well, this seems kind of healthy, right? We're kind of diffusing the situation. It seems like kind of a good idea. And I even think about those fads back from when I was a kid, like when I was young, like streaking and skinny dipping at rock concerts, right? Or mooning. Mooning was very big. And I think, well, those were all about flaunting your private parts, right? So what's the difference between that and sending a picture of your genitals over the internet? And I think, no. No, those were all just for fun, really. Those were all like group romps. This is very different, right? This is personal. My God, it is not all right to send a picture of your penis to my 13-year-old. And I can't believe how long it's taken me to get upset and really angry about this. And I think, why didn't I say to M while I had him on the phone, don't you ever, ever do that again. I will send you to jail. I will put you in juvie. But now it's summer vacation, and we are in the country here, and I come down for breakfast, and I see my 13-year-old sitting there at the table eating some cereal. And I say to her, honey, were you shocked when you looked at that photograph? And she says, yes. Just the way she'd say, duh, or uh-huh, you know, of course. And I think I've been such a terrible mother. I have got to make it up to her right now for being such a terrible mother. And I say to her, honey, what he did was wrong, and it's an assault. And bye-bye, she says, and she walks out the door. She hates talks. I kind of don't blame her. But 2 days later, I see her at the far end of our yard where we have this old wooden swing set that we've had for a really, really long time, and she's swinging out there on it. Now, when there's absolutely nothing else to do, she does go out there, and she swings back and forth, just rocking herself into a kind of a reverie, and I watch her, and I think, has she gotten that photograph out of her mind? Will she ever? She's not telling. She just keeps swinging back and forth, back and forth. Thank you.
Jenny Allen, Jenny Allen.
Jenny Allen's humor essays appear in The New Yorker, The New York Times, and other publications. She performs her solo show, I Got Sick, Then I Got Better, around the country. If you want to see the picture that inspired Jenny's story, well, that's not at our website, themoth.org, but you can stream the stories for free and send the link to your friends and family. We'll be back in a moment with stories of disaster at sea and disaster at home.
Support for The Moth comes from Odoo. What is Odoo? Well, Odoo is the only software your business will ever need. Featuring a suite of integrated business applications, Odoo connects your business operations together so that you can get more done in less time. Odoo has apps for everything. CRM, accounting, sales, HR, inventory, marketing, manufacturing, you name it, Odoo's got it. To learn more, visit odoo.com/moth. That's odoo.com/moth.
Seeing people who look like you out in the world telling stories generates connection and inspiration. As a young woman, being exposed to Black people in the arts and media helped open me up to a world of possibilities. Black Stories, Black Truths is a celebration of Blackness from NPR. Each of NPR's hosts are as distinct, varied, and nuanced as the Black experience itself. You'll hear stories of joy, resilience, and empowerment, all told from a unique Black perspective. Whether you're listening to a story about the history of Juneteenth on Code Switch, or getting an up-close and personal interview with the likes of Tracy Ellis Ross on It's Been a Minute, a connection is forged. Not only for African Americans, but for anyone who wants a window into our world and the country that we all share. In NPR's Black Stories, Black Truths, you'll find a collection of some of NPR's best podcast episodes celebrating the Black experience. Stories should never be about us without us. Listen now to Black Stories, Black Truths from NPR, wherever you get your podcasts.
This is the Moth Radio Hour from PRX. I'm Jay Allison. You're listening to a live storytelling event that was held on the island of Martha's Vineyard in Massachusetts. Your host is Adam Gopnik.
Our next storyteller is Bill Evel. When I asked Bill, who, and I asked in a painfully jocose way, who would you ban from the beach? What kind of person? And he said, he actually looked me in the eye and he said with the sweetest temperament and diction, he said, I wouldn't ban anybody. Because, yeah, exactly. Could there be a nicer guy? It explains why he fled New York for Martha's Vineyard. Would you welcome, please, Bill Evel.
What can you say when you're nervous? You just love everybody. I met my wife, Catherine, when she was 13 and I was 16. Today, she's the minister at the West Tisbury Church, but you should have seen her back then. She was a punk rock and skateboard chick. In her backyard, they had this huge skateboard ramp. We used to say it was the second largest in all of New Jersey. I have no idea if this was true, and I didn't even skate. I just like to go over there because I like Catherine. She was the little sister, though, of a good friend of mine, and so we didn't date. This was high school, and there's rules against that sort of thing. But we were good friends, and we stayed in touch all through our 20s, but then gradually, we started to drift apart, mostly because I didn't know how to tell her how I felt. We even lost touch for a few years, and then, when I was about 28, I got a call one night from a friend from the old neighborhood, Pete. He was calling to tell me that his parents had been killed. They had been out west and looking for a retirement community, and a truck ran a red light. We all went back to the old neighborhood, Catherine too, for the services. I can still see those two caskets, these two brown caskets, right next to each other. And inside were two people who had meant a great deal to all of us, two people who had been like parents to us. And immediately after that service, I walked right over to Catherine and I asked her out on a date. I wasn't going to waste any more time. For our first date, we both lived in New York City then, and I took her to the finest dive bar in all of the East Village. It's called the Holiday Cocktail Lounge. And over several cheap whiskeys, I discovered to my surprise that she had always been in love with me too. A few years later, we got married, and we decided during the ceremony that since we had known each other for so long, we would walk up the aisle together. She wore a bright red dress. And then about halfway through the ceremony, this guy in the back row stands up and starts waving his arms around and screaming, and he starts saying, "What about that moment? What about that moment we get to say why they shouldn't be together?" The whole place went quiet. And the guy makes his way to the aisle. I thought someone was going to tackle him, and he starts walking up the aisle, and then he gets almost to the altar, and he winks at us. It was our friend Paul. He had said he might do something unorthodox. And he turns around to the crowd and he says, "Isn't that a weird tradition? How about we flip it? How about we say why they should get married?" Everybody breathed a huge sigh of relief. And then they just started standing spontaneously and saying why we should get married. Everything from, "We're both really short," to, "We both looked really great in a red dress." That's a story for a different time. But mostly they kept saying that we just seem made for each other. A little over 4 years ago, we moved to Martha's Vineyard. Catherine was called to the West Tisbury Church, and we had two little kids now. Hardy's was 4, and Arane, who everybody knows as Pickle, was 6 months. Seemed like a great idea. And it has been, other than February. But we settled into a routine. I started working at the Vineyard Gazette, and life was good. And then one day, Catherine called me at work. She was crying, and I couldn't understand her, and the office was kind of noisy, and I took the call outside, and she finally composed herself, and she said, "The doctor found a lump. They have to do a biopsy to be sure, but to prepare for breast cancer." And usually, my mind, when anything goes wrong, it's like, okay, how do we fix it? We can do this, we can do this, we can do this, check the boxes, and we're good. I didn't know what to do then. I just kept thinking, not Catherine. Me, sure, but Catherine's like the greatest person on the planet. Ask anybody. The early diagnosis was pretty good. Maybe just a lumpectomy. They did some surgery, but they couldn't clear the margins. Cancer speak for there were still some cancer cells. They went back in again, but they couldn't clear the margins, and then they found it was in the lymph nodes. We knew we were in for the full fight. We decided early on that we were going to be really open with our kids. Hardy was 7 and a half now, and Pickle was almost 4. We stalled as much as we could, but then One January, beautiful day, was like a 60-degree day. We said, let's go outside. Hardy immediately thought he had done something wrong, but he said, no, no, no. And we went outside, and I still didn't know what I was going to say, but we're walking to his little play area, and there's this stump he kind of jumps around on, and I find a rock as I'm going there, and I pick up this rock, and I put it on his stump, and I said, this was the lump in Mommy's breast. The doctors took it out. And then Hardy just reached forward, and he grabbed the lump, and he threw it in the woods, and I thought, holy shit, this talk is working. And then I reached forward, and I grabbed some dirt, and I put that on the stump, and I said, this was the second surgery. And he swept that dirt away. Then I looked around and I found some sand. And I put that on the stump. I said, they can't get this out with surgery. Mommy's going to have to take some really, really strong chemicals. And it's going to make her hair fall out. Hardy laughed at that. He thought that was kind of funny. But then he stepped up again and swept the sand away. And then he walked over and he grabbed this stick. And he started marching around pretending he was Catherine, saying, good health for me, good health for me. And so then Catherine grabbed a stick, and I grabbed a stick, and Pickle, who had been wandering around kicking a soccer ball, she came over to join the freaks, and we all started jumping around, good health for me, good health for me. I didn't really know how much Pickle got out of this little talk. But then, 2 days later, it was the end of the bedtime routine, and we were lying in bed, and we'd finished reading, and she turns to me and says, Dada, when am I going to die? And I was like, whoa, Pickle, not for a long time. No, 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 not for a long time. And I'm hoping now that the conversation is over. But she turns to me again and says, will I die before you? And I said again, no, Pickle, you're safe. You're not going to die for a long, long time. And then she says to me, I want to die before you. That way I won't have to miss you. I wanted to tell Pickle then that she was never going to die, that I was never going to die, that Catherine was never going to die, that Hardy was never going to die, that anybody on the whole planet was ever going to die again in the history of the world. But I couldn't. I wasn't going to lie to her. So I just held her until she fell asleep. Now, if this wasn't enough, we ended up being really open with the community, too. Catherine's role as a minister is a really public one, and she would preach about cancer. About her, what she was going through in her sermons. Being a minister's husband is a strange role, no matter, even in the best of times. But sitting in the pew when she's talking about her cancer and she would break down, and I'm sitting there watching a girl I've loved since she was 13 years old, and I can't get out of that pew, and I can't go to hold her, and I can't do anything. Then I remember, about two days after one of these sermons, I'm standing in the Scottish Bakehouse, sort of waiting to get a croissant, and this woman comes up to me. I barely know her. And she's in her 80s, but full of life, and she comes in and she just gives me this huge hug, and she wraps her arms around me, and she's squeezing me hard, and then she backs off, and she points at her breasts, and she says, these aren't real. Cancer took them 30 years ago. But I'm doing great. These were the stories we liked best. The old survivors. And then the community, they started bringing over food and they started taking care of the kids. And then when Catherine had chemo, they started bringing over their minister. The congregants started bringing their minister pot brownies and pot sugar cookies. I mean, these pot sugar cookies were art. They were perfection. They were definitely not their first baking experience. Back home, I mean, back when we were just together, I tried the cancer treatment. It took almost a year, and I tried to, like, splice it into three spots. There was the surgery, there's chemotherapy, there's radiation, and then, you know, surgery is, you know what you're getting. But chemo, that's some weird shit. Catherine and I would go into Boston to Mass General every 3 weeks, and she would have these chemicals dripped into her, 4 hours, these bright red chemicals. The nurse called it the Red Devil. And then we'd go home. About a day and a half later, she'd leave us, or my words, for what happened, when she became just sort of a ghostly presence on the couch. Pickle would create a little snuggle spot down there, bring in her blankets and her animals, and she would just pet her mother's ankles. She called it her jewel box. When Catherine's hair fell out, Hardy got this bright blue wig, and he would parade around. And I tried to keep it together, make sure everything seemed normal. But then sometimes I would just break down. And it would happen in the weirdest times. I'd be walking down the street, it'd be a bright sunny day, and I'd be walking along, and then I'd smell something or see something, and it would flash me back, and I'd just break down, and I'd start bawling, and I'd start bawling so much, I'd scare myself. And then I'd start bawling some more, and then I'd scare this person who was just walking by, some stranger. And they'd come over and they'd say, "Are you okay?" And I'd say, "No!" And then I'd run away. But then I had to be a parent when I went back home. And then one morning, we're getting ready for school and Hardy has a tantrum. Something about his socks don't fit right or whatever. Something small, but it's a big tantrum. Something that at age of 3 would be annoying, but at the age of 7, he thought he was like going to be grow up to be a horrible person. And I start yelling at him, and he starts yelling at me, and we're yelling, and then we get in the car, and we're still yelling, and then we get to the school, and we're still yelling, and I think, I can't take him in like this. So I keep driving. A little while, he notices, and he says, "Dada, where are we going?" And I'm still so angry, I just can't speak, so I just keep driving. And then he asks again, "Dada, where are we going?" And I sense the fear in his voice. And I don't answer again, not because I'm angry, but because I'm happy. I'm happy about his fear. The tantrum's over, and I've got the control, and I just keep driving, and he keeps asking me, "Dada, where are we going? Where are we going?" And his voice gets scary, and then he starts to cry, and I keep going, and I can't answer him. Here I am torturing my son, my little boy, and I can't stop. I just keep driving, and this goes on for miles. And then finally, I get to the Tashmu Overlook, and I almost throw up. I'm just sick to my stomach, and I turn around. We drive home. We go inside and we sit on the couch side by side, and I'm apologizing and apologizing, and he turns to me and he says, "Dada, the reason I had the tantrum, I wasn't just thinking about that thing, I just started to think about everything that can go wrong." I tell him I understand exactly what he means. The last part was radiation. Catherine had to go in every day to Mass General. So she moved to Boston. Friends gave her an apartment and she stayed there, and we stayed back home and held down the fort. The kids and I, we created a calendar and we'd mark off the days, getting ready for that last day. Kathleen had said there was a bell. There's this bell in the reception room, and you get to ring it the last day for good luck. In my mind, I had built that bell up. It was like the Liberty Bell. I was going to ring the shit out of that bell. I was going to ring it, and I was going to keep ringing it. I was going to keep ringing it. The orderlies were going to have to come and take me away. And on the last day, we all went in, me and the kids and my mom and Kathleen's sister. And we're treated like celebrities. We're given a tour of the place, and then we get down, and Kathleen finishes her radiation, and she puts back her street clothes, and we all go walking over to the bell. It's a tiny bell. It's about the size of my fist. Kathleen gets up there and she rings the bell, and Hardy rings the bell, and Pickle rings the bell, but then I don't want to ring the bell. It just seems kind of stupid. It doesn't seem like anything's going to change. I'm still scared as hell, and ringing a bell is not going to change anything. And so I fade back into the back. I just want to go home. So that's what we do. Since that day, Kathleen has had checkups every other month, and then this spring she got her 6-month cancer all clear. That was something to celebrate. So we all got together, and the kids, and we're having a big dinner with spaghettis and meatballs, and we're all just laughing and having fun, and then Pickle turns to Kathleen and says, "Mom, remember when you had the cans? Remember how we used to snuggle all the time?" So weird, she was nostalgic for cancer. But I also got it. It was a horrible, horrible year. And yet there were so many beautiful moments. Family, a community, so many of you people out there. We all jumped in open arms into cancer. And yet, and here we were, sitting at dinner, laughing, hanging out, just like any normal family, like it had never happened. And I gotta tell you, that's the weirdest part of the whole thing. Thank you.
Abel. Bill Abel.
Bill Abel is a writer and the managing editor of the Vineyard Gazette. Our final story from a legendary seafarer in just a moment. From PRX, this is the Moth Radio Hour. I'm Jay Ellison, producer of this radio show. You're listening to a live Moth event from the Tabernacle in Oak Bluffs on the island of Martha's Vineyard in Massachusetts. The theme of the evening is Fish Out of Water. Here's your host, Adam Gopnik.
We have only been on our three-day visa here on Martha's Vineyard for about 24 hours, but already our next storyteller is familiar to me. He's such a legendary figure here. First thing I heard when I got off the ferry is I was on the boat with Buddy Vanderhoop and people telling me stories about him. He's a genuinely remarkable figure, and he's going to tell us a wonderful story. And when I asked Buddy, what's the one kind of person you would banish from the beach? He looked at me and said, anyone with clothes on. Would you welcome, please, Buddy Vanderhoof.
Good evening. My name is Captain Buddy Vanderhoop. I'm a Wampanoag Indian from Gayhead, from the Wampanoag tribe of Aquinnah. And I had the occasion, growing up, talking to my elders who were seafaring men and women. I listened to stories for years, and some of the advice that they gave me, they told me that the ocean is a playground, but you should always respect the ocean because it can turn on you and harm you and even kill you. So just respect the ocean, which I have always done and always kept this in the back of my mind. And one day, I had a tuna fish charter. My boat was broken down and was being repaired, so a friend of mine lent me his boat, which was a 32-foot wooden boat, the Escort. Charles Ogletree, professor at Harvard, the head of the law department, was one of my clients. Dennis Sweet, another highfalutin lawyer from Mississippi, was one of his colleagues and friends, was there. Charles's father-in-law was there, who was 78 years old, and Jen Clark decided to jump on the boat as my first mate that day. So we put all of our lunches and stuff in the cooler, got all the fishing gear on the boat, headed out of Menifee Harbor. As we rounded Gayhead, the wind was about 10 to 20 miles an hour that day, and Charles's father-in-law started getting seasick. But if you've ever been on the boat with Charles Ogletree, it doesn't matter once you leave the dock. If you're seasick or not, you're going for the day. So we rounded Gayhead, headed down for the dumping grounds, which is 40 miles south of Gayhead, a place that was made famous by Frank Mundus in his search and quest for great white sharks. And we were in search of yellowfin tuna. So we get down there. It was a little bumpy going down, but it actually turned out to be quite a nice day. And we were having a great day of fishing. It was a beautiful, flat, calm day. And this was late afternoon. We had 13 fish on the boat. It was 3:30 or 4 o'clock in the afternoon. We saw all the other boats heading north going home, but we decided we'd be a little greedy because we were catching so many fish. We stuck around for another round of fish, and Charles hooked into the biggest fish of the day, about 4:30, quarter five. It was about 120-pound yellowfin, and he was in the chair reeling him in. All of a sudden, I look back, and the fish is 100 feet behind the boat, and he's got a 350-pound mako charging in on the tuna fish. I said, Charles, reel, get that fish in. The mako hit the fish, took its whole belly out. I said, get him in. So he finally reeled him in, got him to the boat. I gaffed him, pulled him over the rail, got him on the boat. He only had damage to the underside of him, so most of the fish was still good. And just about the time that that fish hit the deck, the motor died. I said, oh no, here we are 45 or 50 miles south of the vineyard. I went up, turned the key, no clicks, nothing. The ammeter gauge was over below 9 volts. So I said, well, maybe if I give it a half an hour, 45 minutes, the battery will recharge itself or come up a little bit enough to start the diesel motor. And so I cleaned the fish, cut the head of the fish off. There were no guts left because the Mako enjoyed those. And I decided I'd put the fish head, the tuna fish head, on a hook to see if we could catch the Mako that had the rest of my fish. So, well, 15 minutes later, Charles hooks up to a pretty nice shark, about a 400-pound shark. We got him in, and it was just a blue shark. So we pulled him in next to the boat. I cut the leader off, and then I said, well, it's been about a half, 45 minutes. I'm going to try the motor again. Hit the key, nothing. So the sun's going down. It's really, we're in a bleak situation right now. We're drifting south. We're already 45 or 50 miles south of the vineyard. I look over to the northwest and the sky's totally black. It was just a nightmare. And 10 minutes later, we had a major thunderstorm over us, lightning all around the boat. The winds picked up to 25 or 30 miles an hour. It's getting dark. And then the thunderstorm's over. It's a little bit calm. The seas have built up to 4 to 8 feet. We're dead in the water, in the slosh, sideways. And it's just about dusk. You can just barely see the little piece of light where the horizon was. And I saw a boat on the horizon. Well, I had brought two 2,500-foot parachute flares with me on this trip, as part of my emergency kit anyway. So I shot one up, and it lit up the whole ocean for a mile around us, it seemed. The boat saw it, saw the boat turn toward us, and 20 minutes later, the boat is pretty close to us. The two members of the boat, the lobster boat, came out on deck, and they said, what's the problem? I said, well, we're broken down, the batteries are dead, we have no way to get back to Menemshe. Could you please tow us back to Menemshe? And the captain says, do you have any beer? Charles Ogletree said, yes, we have a six-pack of Red Stripe beer. And as the mate said, yeah, man. So, so they throw a line over. We put the beer in a plastic bag. They pull the beer over, throw a line. We hook it up to the bow cleat. And it's 4 to 8 foot seas. It's blowing 25 or 30 miles an hour. They start hauling us up north toward Martha's Vineyard. Well, the wind is increasing all the time. It's blowing 35 now. Seas are almost 10 feet tall. Waves are crashing over the front of the boat, and all of a sudden the line parts. Well, these guys are up in the pilot house of their lobster boat drinking Red Stripe. They kept on going. Their stern light's getting smaller and smaller. It's going down in the wave, and finally it's totally out of sight. I said, oh my God, these guys don't even know that they dropped us. They're drinking beer and having a blast in the wheelhouse, and here we are back in the slosh in these 10-foot waves now, and it's just, I mean, it's critical. So they, finally, I see the port and the starboard light coming back to us. A half an hour later, they're beside us again. It's blowing 40 to 45 miles an hour now, and it's really, really getting nasty. I mean, scary nasty. They threw us a line again. They towed us for maybe a mile, and the rope parts again. They this time knew that they dropped us, turned around, said, well, we can't help you anymore because the rope's too short. We don't have anything any thicker, so we're going to call the Coast Guard right now, and we'll stand by you until they get here. So they call the Coast Guard. Here we are, it's blowing 50 miles an hour now. The seas are building to 15 to 18 feet. We're sideways in this stuff, and it's just the outriggers are slamming into the mast. It's just a horrible scene. And Dennis Sweet looks over at the other boat. They have deck lights on. They have lights on in the wheelhouse. He said, I got to get out of here. I'm going to go over to that boat. I'm swimming. And I said, Dennis, how are you going to get on the boat when you get over there? And did you forget about the sharks that we just caught about an hour and a half ago? And all the blood that's been pouring out of the scuppers of this boat since we've been rolling here in the slop? So he aborted that idea pretty quickly. So all of a sudden, Charles, his father, has been seasick all day long. He's huddled in the back of the boat. He's got blankets over him. He hasn't moved one inch in 5 hours. Charles says, buddy, could you go over and nudge my father-in-law and see if he's still alive? So I went over, gave him a little nudge. He grunted, and he was in bad shape because he'd been dehydrated for now going on 12 hours or 13 hours, and he was alive. So the boat's outside of us. The Coast Guard's on their way. All of a sudden, it's blowing 60 to 70 miles an hour. It's unbelievable. This is an unforecasted storm, and we're in 20-foot seas right now. All of a sudden, these two gigantic rogue waves, I'm talking waves 3.5 stories big, 230, 35-foot waves. We go up this wave, come back down. The second one hits us so hard, it tips the boat up 90 degrees. The rail goes under the water, and it seemed like the whole ocean came into the on deck at one time. We took on 5,000 to 8,000 gallons of water on that one wave, and I'm getting really nervous now. Everybody else, I said, okay, don't lose your calm. That was really, really bad. I know how bad it was. Everybody put your life jackets on. Everybody get your, here's a flashlight for everybody. I said, if we get hit by another set of these waves, we're gonna roll the boat over. And don't try to go over the sides. Keep your wits about you. Go over the stern, stay together, put your flashlights on, hang on to the boat. It was mind-blowing how bad the seas were that night. The Coast Guard, I saw a boat on the horizon finally. The Coast Guard, I had one more of those 2,500-foot parachute flares left. I shot it off, went up, lit the whole ocean up around us. Half an hour later, the Coast Guard's outside of us saying, with their little bullhorn, we're gonna pull up alongside of you. I said, don't pull up alongside of us. We have a wooden boat. We're either gonna smash into you and sink, or you're gonna smash into us and we're gonna sink. I think these guys are all from Ohio or Indiana or something. They'd been to the Coast Guard Academy and they're now doing real-time stuff. They had forgotten their booklets, I think, that day. So they were so seasick. They had all their deck lights on. You could see them barfing over both sides of the boat. And they were all so weak. I was out on the front of this 28-foot boat in 25-foot seas, holding on for dear life. I mean, I'm like a windshield wiper on the front deck, going back and forth, waiting for them to get a rope over me so I could hook it up so they could get us under tow, which took over an hour. I was so pissed off. And I couldn't even start screaming at them because they just wouldn't have done any good anyway. But they finally got a rope to us and we're under tow. We're in 20-foot seas. I mean, the waves are just coming totally over our boat, which was pretty scary in itself. We had no bilge pump. We had no electricity whatsoever. We couldn't even communicate with the boat that was towing us. So it took 23 hours for them to tow us back to Menemsha. So all in all, it was a 34-hour tuna fishing trip. Finally, we got back. Nobody gave a shit about all the tuna fish we had. Their loved ones were on the dock. Everybody's getting hugs and tears, and everything is hunky-dory because we're alive. And I attribute this to my elders that gave me the advice that, and I'd like to pass this on to everyone in the audience, that you have to respect the ocean. The ocean's a great playground, but you have to respect it because it will kill you. And Charles Ogletree still goes fishing with me. He's my best client. Dennis Sweet, he will fish with me if I have two keys, which means you have two engines, so you can get back on one. Charles Ogletree's stepdad will never step foot on another fishing boat as long as he lives. And that's my story. Thank you very much.
Buddy Vanderhoof. Buddy Vanderhoof.
Captain Buddy Vanderhoof is a Native American of the Wampanoag tribe of Aquinnah. He owns and operates Tomahawk fishing charters and is widely known for his ability to catch big fish. You can see photos of some of those big fish at our website, themoth.org. That's it for this episode of the Moth Radio Hour. We hope you'll join us next time. And that's the story from the Moth. Your host this hour was Adam Gopnik, New Yorker staff writer and author of the books Paris to the Moon and The Table Comes First, Family, France, and the Meaning of Food. The stories were directed by Meg Bowles and Catherine Burns. The rest of the Moth directorial staff includes Sarah Haberman, Sarah Austin Jeunesse, and Jennifer Hickson. Production support from Jenna Weiss Berman and Brandon Echter. Moth stories are true as remembered and affirmed by the storytellers. Moth events are recorded by Argo Studios in New York City, supervised by Paul Ruest. Our theme music is by The Drift. Other music in this hour was performed live at the event by Carla Kilstead. The Moth Radio Hour is produced by me, Jay Allison, with Vicki Merrick at Atlantic Public Media in Woods Hole, Massachusetts. Atlantic Public Media was a sponsor of this live show, along with the Cape and Islands public radio station, WCAI. Special thanks to Kitty Burke and Trish Hahn. This hour was produced with funds from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the National Endowment for the Arts, and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. The Moth Radio Hour is presented by the Public Radio Exchange, PRX.org. For more about our podcast, for information on how to pitch your own story, and everything else, go to our website, themoth.org.